Hello and welcome to the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, the podcast all about board games, and the people who love board games. I am Matt Lees, and I'm joined by Tom Brewster.
Hi, I'm Tom Brewster, and this episode of the podcast is done across the sea.
Oh my gosh, that's true. I'm currently in a different landmass.
I'm on the same sad little sinking landmass that we've come to know and love over the years.
Is it sinking? Since I haven't been away for long, is it sinking? Did you pull the plug out?
I'm in a puddle.
Did you pull the England plug out?
I'm in a very, very tall puddle right now.
My gosh. Podcasting from a puddle, that's commitment. That's commitment. I feel like being up to your legs or waist in water is actually going to make the quality of the audio worse, but it's still commitment of a sort.
The whole thing is just flowing beautifully. The ripples around me, it's zenning me out. It's chilling me as I slowly become submerged in the briny deep.
Well, don't zen out too far because we've got to record a podcast and I don't want to just ask you for an opinion on a board game and get the sound of a whale and a gong being hit softly in the background. Can you start us off with a whale? On this podcast, we're going to be talking about The Great Sea. We're going to be talking about Dark Pact, and we're going to be talking about a fun little word game with a marker board. What's it called, Tom? I think I did quite well to remember two of the names off the top of my head, frankly.
The last game is Typeset. Well, it kind of gives us a nice little arc to the podcast. Great Sea, Dark Pact, Typeset. You know, it's like very staccato and aggressive. I'm a big fan.
The adjective special. I've done lots of things and said lots of things purposefully wrong over the years to slightly annoy people on the internet, but suggesting that type is an adjective I think might be a new low.
It's going to push them over the edge.
First of all, on today's podcast, I'm going to tell you about The Great Sea. This is a game designed by S.J. McDonald and Zach Smith with art from Sam Phillips, and it's published by Garfield Games. Not to be confused with Garfield Games. I hate Mondays and I love lasagna and I will kill again.
That's the designer of Magic the Gathering.
Yes, he hates Mondays, but he does love lasagna.
And lands.
Lands. Why haven't they released the Magic the Gathering Lanzagna cards?
Well, no, that's in the Italian expansion, I think. You can buy it on shelves today. The delicious continent of Italy represented in your Magic the Gathering game. Vast swathes of delicious pillowy lasagna to play your minions on top of. I've never played Magic the Gathering.
I want to play
how it works.
I'm going to tap three linguine and two ricotta to move this
Super
this
Mario
bigger ball of meat
into
balls.
Position.
Super Mario is one of the special commander cards, I think.
Oh,
actually, it's like a special character.
Yes.
The Great Sea is based in dominating the Mediterranean. It's the distant shores of Carthage from their homelands, the Levant. That's right. I don't know anything about this period of history. I'm reading off of the Board Game Geek page for it. It's a game of people who look old-fashioned, like kind of Viking-y style, being on boats, moving boats around, and fighting each other. It's a part of the Scarabraeaverse, as we're calling it, and I don't think anyone else is.
It says on BoardGameGeek that they're part of the Ancient Anthology series.
Well, I think it's on us, frankly, that we have been sleeping on the Scarabraeaverse and the fact that we didn't even find out it existed until the sixth game, Scarabraeaverse.
That's true.
But hey, that's on us. Scarabraeaverse is the only one I've really seen, apart from this. Obviously, that was a game about trying to fill a shed and getting your shed filled with fluff by accident as part of the process. But that was like that really peak, like, organization joy. Whereas this is a board game ass-looking board game, okay? It's got similar mechanics. Yes, it's still a Euro-y game. But guess what, Tom? You've got boats because you're in the sea.
Oh, yeah.
You're moving boats around.
Oh, yeah.
You're taking control of islands.
No way.
And making buildings on them.
Oh, my
You're making
goodness.
More ships.
Oh!
And you're fighting other people's ships in battles and destroying them.
Give me that board game.
Honestly, it's possibly too exciting. I think it's maybe going against the grain of what the Scarabraeaverse is all about, in my absolutely incompetent opinion.
The games on from that series that I've played, Scarabraeaverse, which is a game basically organizing a shed, and Hadrian's Wall, which is like the most spreadsheeted roll and write I've ever played, in brackets positive, it's a good game.
Yes.
So this being kind of like a fighty area control type deal by the looks of things, with some buildings and some dice, oh, there's so much game happening right here. It's different. It's definitely different.
It is. It is. And honestly, very mean. I like this a lot. I thought it was really fun. I only played it with two, and I think it would definitely be better with three. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a sweet spot because it is kind of a Eurogamey thing where you're getting resources, you're spending resources, you're trying to optimize your turns by placing things, you're getting cubes, you're moving around. But it's a game where you also can have your dinner spat in by another player. You are trying to win. It's not something where you get to the end of the game and you go, we got the most points. You basically have these opposing score tracks. And the idea is you have on the one side, like this kind of glory tracker, which is for controlling bits on the map, for having like big, good buildings out there, your usual area control stuff. And then on the other side, moving in the opposite direction, you have a different score track, which is for like winning battles, or like doing good trading stuff, being a money person. And the idea of the game is you just need to get two of those things to align. So, you need to get either the combat or the mercantile token, which is coming from the left and going further right as you get points, and the glory thing to basically be overlapping on the same like line downwards. It means it's an end point to the game that's a little malleable. Rather than being like, you have to get to 8 glory points or you have to get 8 battle points, it means you can do lots of one thing and a little bit of the other, or a bit of both of them and meet in the middle. Right. It just generally means that like it's a slight tug of war, particularly because the kind of points you get for battling and the points you get for doing commerce stuff, they're going to go up permanently, whereas the glory points you get taken away from you. I should point out, I'm calling them glory points. I don't know if that's what they're called, and honestly, it's fine. I don't care. It's kind of a Euro game. These things go up and down as you lose things. So if you lose control of an island, then the other player gets that point. It goes down again. Honestly, a lot of the DNA of this game is kind of Twilight Imperium-y in a weird way.
Whoa.
In lots of the kind of like the way that points are temporary, and also in the way that the combat works slightly. I'll come back to in a little bit. So you mentioned dice earlier, Tom. You're not actually rolling a dice in this game.
Oh.
At the start of the game, you have a dice of your color on each of your 6 actions, and they all level up as you go through the game. So they start on 1. And then one of the first actions you can do is you can develop stuff. So you can basically go, hey, I'm going to rank up some of my other dice to make those actions better when I'm using them.
Yeah.
And on your turn, you get to just two actions. You can choose two of these cards to activate in any order you like. And they all do different things. You can like fortify to put new buildings on the map. And you can trade to like get some money, get some wood, do some things, put some markets down onto the board. You can research, which allows you to like get better stuff. You can improve your boats. Because on your player board, you have these three pictures of boats. You've got little boat, medium boat, big boat.
Traditional
sizes
bear. Yeah, absolutely.
Sizes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Bears and boats aligned in sizes. They start off with specific stats. You can upgrade them to give them like better, like, you know, better base stats, cheaper production costs. And then also, like, you've got a fleet limit, which you can upgrade, again, which tells you, like, how many different types of ships you can have in one space.
Mm.
Which, again, it's a little bit TIE. The thing about the boats that's cool, though, is each of them have, like, these little, like, slots on them that you can then replace with upgrade bits. So you can make your different types of boats better. So you could go mad for making your little boats really speedy, or making your medium boats really good at attacking stuff, or whatever. And then you can be basically putting them out into the map at your ports, mobilizing them to move them around the world, and effectively trying to take control of the sea, take control of these islands. The wrinkle here, as you might expect, is that there's all sorts of reasons why you might want to be overstretched and doing too much, which is, you know, the classic magic source of any area control game. You know, you have these little markets that you can place out onto islands. And if you have lots of them, then at the start of your turn, you can like flip over a bunch of them to get a bonus at the same time. So you kind of want to be stretching out all over the board, being annoying, taking control of everything in a way that leaves you open. Other people come in, they destroy your stuff.
You want to be holding all the cucumbers, but the cucumbers are cylinders and they're going to roll around in your arms.
Exactly. And you're going to be encouraged to hold as many cucumbers as you possibly can, even though you know it's not a good idea. Another thing that's going to encourage you to spread all over the board is that three of the locations on the map are going to have these special tiles on that if you control that area, then you get to replace one of your like basic 6 action cards with a better one. So like one player will just have a better version of like research because they're controlling that area. And if someone else wants it, they got to take it off you.
I like that.
Yeah. Like there's all sorts of reasons why you might be going to try and eat someone else's lunch. And there's all sorts of reasons why you might overstretch yourself, which I think is always a good foundation for any area control thing. The bit that really surprised me, and actually I was immediately going, oh, I don't know about this, but it kind of worked, was the combat system in it is weirdly very complicated.
Okay.
So you have five different statistics, basically, that are a part of your ship's, like, combat.
Okay.
You have, like, you have shields, which block attacks. You have attacks, which are attacks. And then you have, like, a burning fire symbol, which basically can cut through defenses. And then you have, like, speed, which is who goes first. And then you have the little purple man token, which is, like, if it's a tie, who's got the most people who then just, like, get onto the other boat and finish it up bloody style, etc.
I see.
I was like, oh, gosh.
That's a lot of parameters.
But this either side of the board, like, you have, like, whoever's involved in the two fights, you have these chunky tokens. So you just literally put out all your tokens in the spot. And then it's actually very easy to work out what happens and work out who wins. And you just go, okay, well, I've got more attack. I attack first. I destroy or damage some of your ships, knocking them over sideways. It means you can really spec your ships in interesting ways. You can make ships that are just like, I don't care about like trying to defend. I'm just going to have ships that throw fireballs at your ships and just destroy them and just eat through your shields and just sink your things. You know, you can kind of spec your little ships and big ships in quite interesting different ways, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I feel like having that flexibility is something that's really nice in an area control game. Like having some personality in your ships is great. Do you think that it's readable enough for everyone around the table? Like, can you see how much someone has in a certain category at a glance? Or is it going to be something that's a bit muddy and myopic and hard to work out? Because that's normally my problem with that kind of modular nature, is that you think you're going into battle with something that has just the right amount of defense that you'll be able to surmount it. But then between one turn and the other, suddenly they upgraded their ship and now they're a bit more chunky. And that problem tends to scale with player count as well. Or do you think this is like nice and readable and easy to spot?
I think it's a middle ground. I think it is, you know, because these symbols are just like colored circles, it's not too hard at a glance to see like, okay, that person's got a lot of those on their ship.
Right.
And yeah, it's not like the easiest thing in the world to spot with that. But also there's something else in the fact that you also have almost like Concordia style, you have a little battle deck. Not that there's battles in Concordia
style.
Concordia's not right.
Game of Thrones, the board game style.
Everyone has the same deck of attack cards. And basically, when you go into a fight, you can either use it and play it for the ability, or you can play it for... You know, I don't know why I said Concordia. That's just a madness. Ignore that. you can either play it for the ability, or you can play it upside down and just have extra stats.
Right, okay.
And then if you win the fight, that card that you played is out of the game. So it means that if you are attacking a lot and winning a lot, then other players know what cards you've spent, what cards you have fewer options, etc.
Is there a chance for you to get rid of all of your cards then?
I don't think so.
Or do they cycle back or something?
Maybe they cycle back. And honestly, I can't remember. We maybe used only three or four of them tops.
Cowards.
In the game.
Coward games.
Well, you only lose it if you win, right? And you only win some of the fights.
Yeah.
So...
Not me.
So there's always an element of... there's always an element of the unknown, right? And one of the cards has an ability which is basically like whatever symbols are on their card, mine copies them, which is a really nice one. It's almost like that one's like a guaranteed win, right? Mm-hmm. If you think someone's going to play a card and they're going to stop me, then you can be like, nah, I've got better stats now. I got this. Which is nice because, yes, you've won, but you can't do that again. Honestly, there was a lot of stuff I really liked about this game. I wasn't 100% on a couple of bits. Like, the player boards have a lot of the rules kind of printed on them in a way which does sort of make sense, but also, like, I felt like it could have been neater. It could have been more like a little reference card rather than clogging up the board with all of this stuff.
Yeah, at a glance, it definitely looks a little overwhelming for a game that I think, by the sounds of things, by this sort of combat that you're describing, it sounds kind of like frothy and like kind of fun and like not daft necessarily, but like, you know, not something that's that precise. And so to have all of this text.
Well, I mean, I think like that's the interesting thing about it is like the battle stuff is a little unknown, but I think that's one of the reasons why I thought, oh, I think Tom would like this game, but I think a lot of people might not gel with it is because it's not that frothy, right? It's like, yes, you might, somebody else might play a card that surprises you and then they win the fight and you lose some ships, etc. But the process of getting those ships optimally and, you know, reinforcing them and moving them around and researching them, it's all very Euro game, right? So it's like you've put a lot of work into making something happen and to making this machine work, and then someone else comes and sinks your machine, right? which is, I think you've got to be able to enjoy that as a beat in the story, a beat in the game, and not be like, well, this sucks, you know?
Because I
did a lot of work there and now you've sunk it. But yeah, it's a little bit less clean than it could have been, I think, in terms of the presentation and in terms of the sizing of stuff. I think you talked about, like, is it easy at a glance to see what other people's ships' abilities are? I think, like, you know, the actual ship bits could have been chunkier in terms of the bits you're building out on the board. There could have been more room for that. And then also, it's a minor quibble, but it has this very annoying system whereby you have a shop of tiles that you can research to add to your boats or improve your building types as well, which is also a thing you can do, improve the defensive or bonus capabilities of your little forts across the board. Every time you buy one, it shuffles along those shops down into different sections. So all of the 5 pieces go down to 4, all of the 4 cost pieces go down to 3, all the 3 cost pieces, etc. And it kind of like cycles around. But it means you have to move all of these little small stacks a lot, which is, we just stopped doing that because it was really annoying and you kept knocking them over in a way that was sort of bonkers, because it could have just been having some tokens that you moved instead of having to move all of the tiles. You could have just moved one piece. I don't know. It was a weird like ball drop at a point where I was like, that's really fiddly and annoying. Why is it like that? But again, I think that's more of an indication of the fact that like otherwise, like this was a really nice small box, mean little game that I had a lovely time playing and thought it was really cool. Thought it was really close to being like great. And I think actually it's just like the pretty good C, the good C. Oh, this game is pretty much final. It's just finished up on Kickstarter recently, and these are things that may well change, any of the things that I wasn't sure about. So take everything I've said with a slight pinch of salt, because some things might slightly change. It's good. I liked it. It was good.
Next up on this podcast, I want to tell you, Matt, and you,
me?
The listener, about
them?
Dark... Yeah, them out there listening. I want to tell you about Dark Pact. This is a game designed by Thomas Lehman, with art by Doug Nation, and published by Trick or Treat Studios. And I've been catching some little ripples of excitement out there for this one, Matt. Obviously, it's designed by Tom Lehman, who you might know for Race for the Galaxy or Res Arcana, which are both games that we really like. Race and Roll for the Galaxy, of course, entries into our fastidious, into our enlightened, into our powerful top 100 list of board games, our canonical
unimpeachable list of 100 board, I think, games.
Impervious list of board games. So I thought I'd give this one a go, and I think it's kind of interesting. It's sort of this accelerated deck building game that gives you, at the very start of the game, the deck that you have is kind of like, it represents almost like a mid-game deck in any other deck builder, but it starts you at that point, and then it kind of goes a little bit wild with it, is kind of the elevator pitch for Dark Pact. To explain the very basics of it, you've played Dominion at some point, hopefully.
Yeah.
The basics of this game are very Dominion. You have a bunch of cards in your hand, and you play the cards to take actions, and then when you're done taking actions, you play all the money from your hand to buy new cards, and then you cycle your deck, doing this over and over again, hopefully improving the contents of that deck to get better and better and better hands. All the cards that you buy, instead of being from a sort of pre-made set like in Dominion, there's just one giant deck of cards that gets filtered out into this market. And the cards you can buy are pretty standard deck building fare. You can buy new actions that will let you buy more cards, or they'll let you bounce things back from your discard pile, or they'll let you keep things in a little personal shop so that someone else can't buy them from the market. There's some wrinkles to some of these, like some of the new kinds of money you can buy. Like, you know how in Dominion you can use some money to buy a slightly more efficient, better piece of money? That's here too.
Do I?
Oh, yeah. But some of the money is like a little weird. So an example is there's one which is like a lucky coin that always returns to your hand. So it basically means you have one money permanently, which is something that would be a little game breaking and strange in Dominion. And all of this stuff is kind of like quite typical, right? Like, you are building a deck that has cards that are going to give you access to more actions, cards that are going to give you access to more money, and then cards that are going to give you access to more cards. The thing that's really interesting, or immediately jumped out at me when I was reading the rulebook, are these multiplier cards that you can buy. You buy them just like any other card. They go in your discard pile. They cost a certain amount of money. But you can then later play them alongside cards from your hand, and they multiply every numerical value on the card you played. It's exciting, right? It was immediately very exciting.
Yeah, man.
If you have a card that says, you know, take one action, gain one extra action, so you can play another card, gain one money, and gain one draw, and you play it with a times two, now you are gaining two money. You are drawing two cards. You are taking two extra actions. And then you can stack these. So if you had a times two and a times three, you're taking six times the original actions on that card.
Wow.
You can technically stack this to like infinity, at which point it gets truly bizarre. And it leads to these turns which are like bonkers. Like, we had a thing
like
where...
endless.
Yeah, like these kind of like turns where you literally draw your entire deck because you just have an engine that just goes completely off the chain. You have these turns where, like, we had a whole situation where I had a thing that let me like draw and discard cards, but it also meant other players would do the same. And everyone around the table kind of groaned when it got to my turn because they knew that they were going to have to like basically look at their whole deck and like choose which cards they wanted to keep. It was too much thinking.
Yeah. That's giving me the same energy of like, you know, I've been playing a bunch of the Slay the Spire 2 co-op. And, you know, I think especially when you're just playing two player, one of the downsides of it is that, you know, you can have it one player and their deck is popping and the other player's deck is fine. And not only do they have a game that's like, this is all right, but it means that you just have turns where it's like, and now I'm done. And you're like, okay, I'll be done in about 5 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It definitely has that kind of Slay the Spire 2. You know, for a little tangent here, why not? I feel like Slay the Spire 2 is a game that, from Slay the Spire 1, has kind of gone a little bit nuts with like its numerical scaling. Like, everything in that game feels much more like poppy and immediate and engine buildy than the very slick and sharp Slay the Spire 1. And I think I quite like that about Slay the Spire 2 recently. But Dark Pact kind of feels like that for just deck builders as a whole. It's like you've played Dominion, Dark Pact feels like the Dominion 2 in that it kind of chucks away any pretense of being this like sort of really precise engine and instead turns into this thing that's just kind of nuts.
Yeah, which I think is really fun. And I think a lot of the time, you know, we said this way back when games like... when Slay the Spire and stuff came out, and then we saw games like Hearthstone, and Hearthstone when it first launched was kind of a bit boring because it wasn't really taking advantage of like the digital nature of it. It wasn't taking advantage of just how weird a digital card game can be. And I think that's not true anymore. I think they've updated it so much that like it started to be like, okay, create a random card and stuff like that. It's like, why not? Why not just like do something you can't do on a table? Whereas I'm looking at this, and whilst it does make me very excited, the ability to be like times three, times three, times three, it does make me think, a computer can draw 18 cards very quickly. I can't. And I think, like, is there a degree to which, like, it's fun and poppy, but sometimes annoying?
Yes, absolutely. I think that that's, like, the kind of problem that I have with this game, is that in theory, I should really like it. I like those moments where you get to make these kind of like massive combos in games. It is exciting. But I think the two things that kind of hold it back a little bit for me is that there is a kind of a lot of associated admin with having this like beautiful engine that you've constructed, in that running that engine can just be a bit tedious when you're doing it from turn one until the very end of the game. There's a reason that it's so satisfying in something like a Slay the Spire, where you manage to get your deck really off the rails at the end of a run, and then the run ends. Then you're finished with your deck building adventure. Whereas with this, it kind of keeps you in that pocket for like 60 or 70% of the game's playtime, which can be like a little bit weird and draining. I do think that something I'll touch on that I think is really cool, though, is that like the game knows that it has to kind of scale its objectives to fit that kind of absurd space that it's playing in.
Mm-hmm.
The game gets its name from these Dark Pacts, which are 13 cards that are somewhere in this massive deck that are essentially objectives that let you win the game if you achieve them. There's not any given like end game state that everyone is chasing for. You are sort of tailoring your deck to do one specific thing really well, and those things always kind of lean into a kind of slightly absurd endpoint. Like, for example, one of the Dark Pacts is just have 40 money just unspent sitting around that you can just like say, that's me, I've
just
won the game.
Knocking about. Where do these come from then? Is it like the objectives in a shared shop deck that's cycling through or something like
they
that?
They are in the same market that all the other cards are in. So you might have for a first few turns, you might not actually have any of those Dark Pacts available, and then one of them comes out and now you've got your objective that you're going to try and race towards. Which is interesting, and I think that it leads to some really like fun, silly little bits of game where like winning with a certain Dark Pact feels like you've done this kind of, you've aimed to do this very specific weird thing to your deck, and accomplishing it is quite satisfying. I really enjoyed one of the ones that I played, which was just have all of your cards in play, like none in your deck, none in your hand, just everything is out on the table. And if you do that, then you fulfill the Dark Pact. Congratulations.
That's fun. Doing it's that like is it's satisfying. break the game, like where yes. The purpose of like doing it is play with the systems. It's the Viva Pinata of card games. A very small handful of people will get that, but
yeah. I do really appreciate though that like that all of this like end game stuff is really tailored to the kind of game that it is. Like it knows exactly what it's trying to do and it just lets you go wild with it. And yeah, I still don't entirely know how I feel about this. I'm not sure whether it's a game that's going to get like faster and more playful and I can get to that end game quicker over time, because right now it's a lot of like slow admin, reading cards, like sorting through all of these different cards in front of you to try and get everything exactly in order. Like you kind of lose track of how many actions or how much money you have, which again might be part of the fun, but for me at least it gets a little too messy at times. But yeah, I'll let you know.
Like carrying the thing, you're like, I'll carry that over here, and I get that, yes, because of this. And yeah, no, I can
it's
see
a
that.
Lot of
I can
that.
See that. As somebody who sometimes finds themselves annoyed with my own builds in Slay the Spire 2, because I've made a build that involves me having to play lots of cards and being like, oh, but I don't want to keep having to play all the. I don't want to have to keep dragging all of these digital cards. That's me just dragging digital cards. You give me real cards. And you basically, there's a point where it's like, are you just asking me to shuffle? What's happening here?
Yeah, this is
what's
shuffling happening? The game. Yeah, I do
but
feel like...
But it looks very neat. Like, it's very interesting. And I like the style. Like, you know, it's got that kind of, like, monochrome, like, culty, weird, dark vibe. Mm. It looks like a fun, strange thing.
You know, I think that as a sort of final point on the aesthetics for this game, I think that all of the individual art pieces, I think, are sharp and nice. And the game, like, looks, you know, pretty good. Maybe one of my problems with it is that the actual, what the cards are and what they are saying and what they are doing all feels a little generic. Like some of the cards have these kind of crazy effects, but the theme on the cards doesn't necessarily reflect the effects that they have. And there's no story to your deck building to some extent. You can't like see the stuff that you are doing happening. It's all very abstract immediately. And it means that like sort of looking through the market is quite tedious because not many of the cards are like immediately recognizable on straight away. It's an interesting thing. I feel like it's close to being something that I'd really like, but maybe not quite there. I'll play some more and figure it out. Finally, on this podcast, me and Matt played a little game called Typeset. This is a push your luck word game designed by Jasper Beatrix and published by DVC Games. Jasper Beatrix, I should note, a collective noun for a team of game designers, developers, artists, and educators in Syracuse, New York, according to their BGG bio that I'm reading out right now. So it's designed by a bunch of different people, and it's a little word game that we really like, I think, it's fair to say.
I think it's awesome. I mean, word games are a really funny one. In fact, that I really love word games, but I don't feel like I get to play them that often because they are one of the few types of games in the world where, like, your pre-existing skills and abilities massively affect your ability to play the game. And because of that, the potential recipe for a cocktail of bad feels is not good. So they're ones that I'm like, ooh, I love this. But the circumstances required for them to thrive often are so specific that they don't come to the table as often as I'd like. However, this one I feel does, because it's less... There is the potential for you to be big brain with it, but actually the big brainness of the game often is where the hubris starts to really slip in.
Absolutely. I think if you're going for like big fancy words in this game, you have a very high chance to shoot yourself in the foot in a way that will be delightful. So the way this game works is you have a little sort of booklet in front of you, which is dry erase. And in that booklet, you are going to be writing some words into a grid. The way that you get to place the letters into those grids is determined by a sort of random pull of these tiles from the box. There is a set number of tiles, sort of Scrabble-style tiles, and you're going to pull them out one by one, and every time a tile is pulled, you're going to write that letter somewhere into your grid. However, it must go in the leftmost space in any of the rows. So let's say I start with an R as my very first letter, and then next time I pull an O, I could either place that O directly next to the R, or I could start an entirely new word. You do this in sets of five. So you draw five tiles, and then you say to everyone, do you want to stop there? And you can sort of cash out your words. Then longer words get you more points. Or you can say, actually, I want another set of five letters, and then you'll place them into your grid. However, the problem comes later on in the game when you've got some sort of words half established, and the right letters just aren't coming out of... the box.
Yeah. The whole rule of the fact that every letter that comes up, you either have to use to start a new word or continue an existing word is fine until you've used all of like your five or six potential word starting slots. And then it's like, hey, this letter has to be added to a word you're doing. You do have a couple of freebies. You have a couple of like options to go, nope, don't want it. Not doing it. Not having that letter. But as soon as they're gone, you really do start to go, ah, okay, and start to have to maybe give up on one of your words and have one of your words being like
a sort of letter graveyard.
Scalooby.
Yes.
Scalooby. We played this with some friends of the show, and I really enjoy the way that Rob was playing. He decided earlier to try and write, like, I think he went for macaw.
Yeah,
like a type of parrot.
Yeah,
and it's like, okay, this is what we're talking about earlier, like, you know, hubris. It's like, cool. It's a cool word. It's a cool word.
It's
Rob.
A cool word. I want to.
And then when new letters kept popping up, he was like, "How about my Macquarie?" And it's like, no, Rob, no. Like, you've built that prison. You live in Macquarie Town now. Like, you could do Macquarie's, and that's it. Like,
yes, exactly.
Macquarie, no.
It kind of rewards players that like keep the starts of their words like nice and open, rather than kind of, they might have a really like spectacular word that's going to use a bunch of fancy letters, because there's, you get extra points for using challenge letters.
Using
sort of all of the different vowels. If you really flex your vocabulary, you will be rewarded. But it's quite dangerous to do that, because it will immediately start putting you into a sort of pocket where you need to find new words that start with Q-U-I that aren't quiz, because you've not got a Z hanging out or something like that.
Yeah. And the fact that when you pull these letters out, they go onto this mat in the middle of the table, which means you can see which ones are available. Like, you'd be like, okay, we've had three S's out. There's one more S. Like, how much are you really going to bank on that S coming out before you've had another F or a G that completely throws a billion sticks into your wheels? And the fact that like the vowels don't come up in the bag, the vowels are just on your little personal thing, and at any point you want a vowel, you can just cross off one of your available vowels and whack it in whenever you like. It felt kind of like roll and writey with a little dry erase booklet.
Yeah.
And especially with the fact that you have like almost these little challenges that you can complete, which unlock new things, be it like a, you know, whatever, a wild letter, or like, you know, an extra one of these. That kind of like crossing stuff off, having little combos every now and then of doing this so I can cross that off. It wasn't too much. It didn't like add cognitive load, but it was very satisfying and very gamey.
Yeah.
And I really liked the way that, because you had this challenge of not just like, can you think of a good word, but like, can you just finish a decent word? It meant there was, even though it was competitive, it felt like there was an unexpected amount of camaraderie around the table. of people being like, oh, I've managed to write milked, and everyone else being like, oh, yay, nice, and someone else being like, oh, I've done milky, you know, like, and like having similarities and difference, and people like, you know, having a bit of like, oh, that's clever, you did that, and then someone being like, I really wish I didn't start one with like FL, and it's like, yeah, I've got like chubbler, my bottom word is chubbler, and you know,
yes,
it had that like joint celebration, but also joint commiseration that I think you don't tend to get in most word games when one person has just smashed everyone else because they're smart.
Yeah, I think that there is like, there are so few rules for a game that has this much game in it, and also this much, like, you're right, like the camaraderie is so there, and also like it's so chill as well, like despite in theory being a push your luck game, it's not that push your luck, but in having these kind of like little fringes of push your luck, it is a really nice like last game in the evening, play it, chill out, write some really stupid words with your friends. And I love that hubristic aspect of it, where you'll get really far into a word that you're like, this is going to get me the full 10 points. And then it suddenly spoils at the end, because even though an L should have come up right now, there's no bloody L's coming out.
Oh, I love as well. Tell them, Tom. Tell them about the little deck of cards.
Oh, yeah. The game also comes with a little deck of challenge cards, I think is what they're called. And they will, you'll just have one, or sorry, special ability cards, sorry. You'll have one of them in any given game, and they will give you something that doesn't necessarily help or hinder. Like, they're a little strange, right? Like, for example, one of the cards is called capitals, which means you can have a proper noun somewhere in your grid, and everyone just has access to that as like an ability that they can use. Or you could have like minding is one of them, which lets you flip or rotate a letter to make it into another letter. So you can flip your M something like that. They're just like, there's not that much consistency between these being something that is like actively hindering you or actively helping you or just being like a weird little sidestep, but it helps give the game a lot of personality, I think, or each individual game a lot of personality.
They feel like mutators almost.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
And now it's like, this is a nice simple game, and then you've got this fun little thing, and they don't just completely change the game. They're always things that you can use once or twice, mm-hmm. and then you're done. But yeah, I thought that was just a really lovely little flex. I thought it was like already a really lovely little package. And that just bumped it over the edge and being like, oh, this is great. This is peak, like, rainy caravan holiday.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
Have a lot of fun with this times.
This one is packed with mum-type gameplay, I think. This is exactly absolutely. The target audience.
Deeply mum-coded. Deeply. Dad will play and pretends he doesn't want to play. But every time he does, he clearly really enjoys it.
And that is the end of this week's episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We talked about The Great Sea. We talked about Dark Pact, and we talked about Type Set on the adjective special, as Matt so accurately described it earlier on.
Oh, I'm going to a special hell.
I'm going to a special kind of hell just for words.
Delicious.
If you want to see more from Shut Up and Sit Down, then we have some cool video reviews up on the channel right now. Matt did a review for Regicide Legacy, a game that I want to play with my hands.
Yeah. ASAP. Annoyingly, I didn't get to like finish filming it before I had to leave the country, which means it's still in my flat, but I'm going to give the copy to Tom because I got a fresh copy, so I didn't spoil it for all the boys and girls at home.
And now I can but spoil that's nice. It just for myself.
I'm happy because that game is like out in the wild, and it's like, you know, I think we always get the fear, especially when it's like something where you're like, I don't know, but I thought it was really cracking. And the fact that the game's out in the wild and people have it already with the first print run and doing a second one now, it's really nice when you put up a review saying, this is amazing, and you just have loads of people being like, yeah, I've got this. It's great.
It's good.
Like, yeah, it's great, right? Shared experiences. They're nice. So I can't wait for you to get your teeth into that.
Yeah, I'm going to get my teeth well into it. I'm going to chew it to death immediately. It's on sight. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you very soon.
Bye.